all the way from the UK, coming up next right here on The Right Stuff. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the best, the only place to be on Tuesday night. That's right, you're listening to The Right Stuff, and you're at the right place at the right time. From England to Canada, from Detroit to the Coconuts, we are showcasing Christian authors worldwide, giving you tips, tools, techniques, and resources for you, the writer, to hone and perfect your craft. Tune in every Tuesday at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, right here on WPJC 104.5. And your host, Parker J. Cole.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of The Right Stuff. I'm the queen of Tuesday nights, Parker J. We are talking to my guest, co-host, and contributor today, Joan Lightning. She is the author of the series Guardians of the Wraith, available on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. Let me tell you, you are going to love this series, high fantasy and everything involved with that. You like J.R.R. Tolkien? You like C.S. Lewis? Well, get ready to listen to Joan Lightning and Guardians of the Wraith. This is a pre-recorded session, so we won't be taking any calls today, but gather your family and friends and tune into the show. You are definitely going to love this edition of The Right Stuff. We're going to go ahead and take a quick short break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Don't go anywhere. More with Parker and her guest on The Right Stuff Radio Show. We'll be right back.
Are you a reader looking for more compelling Christian fiction? Maybe something a little more edgy or a bit more real? Are you tired of most Christian fiction shying away from the truth and settling for a rose-tinted view of the world and its issues? Or are you an author who has a compelling story to tell, but you're afraid it doesn't jive with today's brand of Christian or secular fiction? Are you tired of Christian publishers telling you that your content is too edgy? Or maybe you've tried submitting your content under the radar to secular publishers only to be told your themes are a bit too religious? We invite you to take a look at the Crossover Alliance. We are an online publishing company that specializes in edgy Christian speculative fiction with Christian themes and real-world content. Our company is formed from authors and readers just like you who are breaking into the mainstream and Christian markets with this compelling genre. Head over to the www.thecrossoveralliance.com for all the details on who we are, what we do, and what we accept. Right now, if you sign up for our email newsletter, you'll receive a free digital copy of our first short story anthology. Check us out today and help us spread the word about the Crossover Alliance, where light shines brighter in the darkness.
We're back, and you're hanging out with the queen of Tuesday night, Parker J., and her guests, right here on The Right Stuff.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. You're listening to The Right Stuff here on WPJC 104.5. Again, so very glad you are here with me today. This show is pre-recorded because we're talking to Joan Lightning all the way from the UK. She is the author of the series Guardians of the Wraith, available on Amazon.com. And for my UK listeners, it's also available at amazon.co.uk. It's gotten rave reviews, this series. So if you like high fantasy like J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, these are the books for you. And so without further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest, co-host, and contributor today, Joan Lightning. Joan, how are you doing today?
Hello, Parker. I'm fine, thanks. It's a lovely, warm evening here in England. No rain, thankfully. How are you?
I'm doing good, and let me tell you, thank you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. I never take it lightly when we have our guests with us, especially if they're from the other side of the world. So I'm very glad you took time out of your schedule to be with us today. And I want people to get a chance to know who you are. So go ahead and tell us who you are in your own words.
Well, Parker, to start, I'm 56 years old, so middle-aged, but I don't admit to being middle-aged. I try to avoid it. I'm Christian, I became a proper Christian when I was 18, but I was raised by a Christian family. I'm an archaeologist by profession. That's my day job. I run. I do martial arts. That's Kung Fu, Tai Chi, photography. I paint. Also spin, weave. I don't like to be idle because I'm single, so it's do things or watch telly. And in 2008, I started writing what was supposed to be a short story that turned into a very long fantasy story instead. Don't know what else.
Well, no, it's fascinating that you do so many different things. You're like a Jill of all trades, you know? And so you've got, you know, martial arts, the archaeology. So I take it that you don't have a whip.
I don't have a whip. Oh, no, no. I used to have the hat. But I never did get a whip. trowels, steel toe cap boots, and very muddy trousers. I've had all of those, but no whips. Swords, I've got swords.
That's a short sword, that'll make a difference. I find archaeology fascinating. What does a day in archaeologist look like?
Well, it depends if you're working in the field or in the office. I work in the office these days, but I started out in the field. When I started, it was you'd get into a white van very early in the morning, carrying mattocks, shovels, all sorts of tools, a bag with your food in. You'd get taken out into a field somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and you'd start digging, and it's looking for different coloured soils because that marks where things like ditches and what have you are. And then we'd all be watching our watches, hoping for lunch break. And that usually involved a pub. And then we'd be back on site in the afternoon. And then in the evening, you're absolutely exhausted. You head home to eat an awful lot of food. That's field archaeology. Office archaeology doesn't involve so much mud, thankfully. It dust, yes, but not so much mud.
So when you find artifacts in the ground at an excavation site, the attention to detail, I would think, would be a very vital part of that.
Oh, yes, yes. You have to, when we've identified where a ditch is or where post holes are, and you've got different fills within those cuts, each one's got its own number to identify it, and you have to make sure that your finds are properly labeled with the correct fill number so that when the analysis starts, they'll know which finds came exactly from where, and that helps you to date the different parts of the site, because of course you could have Roman, Saxon, Bronze Age, Medieval, all crisscrossed, and you need to try and separate it out, and it's the attention to detail that does it.
What made you get into archaeology?
It was an accident. It was by chance, really. I was out of work back in the 80s. And that was at the time of the Manpower Services Commission, which was a get people back into work thing that the government ran during the 80s. And they sacked 7 people off a local dig. So I applied for a job and got it. I remember being told in my interview that I could expect to meet some very strange people in archaeology. They weren't wrong. I fit right in. So I've been doing it ever since. I did go to university eventually. I got my degree in archaeology, and I carried on working in archaeology. Now I work in the office doing AutoCAD, all the illustrations, map-based stuff for reports. So it was an accident, but it was a good accident.
What I find fascinating, as being a child who watched Indiana Jones, it's a huge adventure. You know, you go and you find some kind of artifact that's going to change the world. Would you say that everyday archaeology is going to do that?
Probably not change the world, no. Not quite the way Indiana does. It can change things in certain areas. There are places in the world where archaeology has helped people to relearn old systems of, say, watering crops, and so that they now can get water to fields that they couldn't do before because they'd forgotten how to do it in the past, if you see what I mean. Because we forget things. As technology moves on, we forget how people used to do things in the past, and sometimes technology isn't up to doing what's needed for simpler things, and archaeology can sometimes help people relearn how to do things that they used to do. Well, at least how their distant ancestors did them. And these days, especially as we're starting to think we possibly all need to go for a simpler life, there are some things that may become relevant again, like learning how to null mind, which is something I learned. It's a form of knitting. It's how the Vikings knitted. But it's not going to, you know, it's not going to revolutionise the world in the same way that, say, computers have. But I think it does have its place. There are things you can learn from it.
How much of archaeology and the discipline that you've learned through archaeology has been essential to your writing your books in Guardians of the Race?
It's in there. It does crop it up occasionally. There is one scene where there's a couple of characters approaching a city, and one of them starts pointing out all the older parts of the city up over there and how you can see this and that and the other. I'd say, though, as it's sword and sorcery sort of story, in many ways it's more my other hobbies that get into it, like the martial arts. But, of course, there is the attention to detail. Yes, because, of course, archaeology, having studied archaeology, I learned about more primitive ways of life, medieval period. And I would say the world of Wraith is largely set in a world that's somewhere between medieval and just starting the Industrial Revolution. So, yeah, that some of my archaeological knowledge does go into that. It's not something I've really thought of before, to be honest, but it does.
One thing I like about some of the things that you said is that going back to a simpler way of life, we need to relearn these skills because these skills were used for such a long time. And it worked for such a long time. Like we see how we do things now, it has a lifespan or expiration date, whereas these skills from back in the day with more primitive cultures, they lasted for a long time because they lasted a long time.
Glass, for example. That's one thing that I remember from when I was a field archaeologist. Modern glass rots faster than Roman glass. It's incredible. Roman glass, you'll find it and you knock the dust off, and it's almost as good as the day they made it. Modern glass, it only has to be in the ground a few decades, and it's breaking into little bits.
But so it's things like that that make a difference, learning how to use those techniques that they used before to go back to a simpler time.
Go ahead,
please.
No, I think also that there's other things that we need to relearn. Think about sewing, you know, repairing our clothes, patching, instead of just chucking it away and going and buying another one. I mean, so many people now don't know how to sew, don't even know how to cook. And these are, if we're going to go back to a simpler way of life, which we really do need to be thinking about, considering the state of the environment, those are skills that need to be rediscovered while there are still people alive who know how to do them. Sorry, I don't mean to get off on the soapbox there.
Oh, no, you're fine. It's actually something that I also agree with for different reasons, though, because I think if you know how to make your own clothes, if you know how to cook your own food, if you know how to repair your own home, then you can be self-reliant.
Exactly.
Now, mind you, I know how to knit. I know how to, like, darn a needle. That's about it. But I do know how to knit. I love knitting. My grandmother taught me how to knit many years ago. So I can make my own clothes.
Yeah.
They won't be, you know, a designer, but I can make my own clothes. I can make a sweater. I can make gloves and skirts and stuff like that. I can make it, you know. But they won't be designer. They'll be warm. They'll be very warm. So that's how we get that.
Some of the things I've knitted over the years. Yeah. Yeah. I definitely relate to the idea that you make unique. Not mass produced like everybody else's. It's unique. No one else will have anything like what you've made or what I've made.
I like the fact that you use what you've learned and applied it to Guardians of the Race. And for those of you listening, Guardians of the Race is available on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. Now, you're from the UK, And so I'm going to ask this very sensitive question that's sensitive here in the U.S., okay? And one of the reasons why I'm so sensitive is because racial tensions in the U.S. are kind of high right now. And so I have to ask this question because your books have these lovely, gorgeous ethnic features of, I guess you would say, Africans on the cover or whatever. Now, what made you lean towards that? Because some people will be fascinated by that. Because here, the question that is being asked a lot is, should people write about other ethnicities outside of their own ethnicity? Okay.
Right.
Whereas I would say, you don't dictate what I write. Other people have other opinions about it. So I would love to know what made you write and go that route.
Well, this goes back to 2008, and a lady by the name of Tina Scott Newsom, who I believe lives in New York, she was one of my internet friends. And we were in a writing group on a social networking site in 2008. And Tina is a lady of color, and she loves fantasy. But mainstream fantasy, as I'm sure you're aware, is white, almost completely. And so she laid a challenge in the writing group. Could somebody write a short story? And she actually described the first two characters, Christu and Tam. And she came, said she wanted a people who had these seven gifts of magic. She wanted a dark lord who was going to propose marriage to the young woman, Christu. And could somebody take this idea and write a story? At that time, I had only written short stories. Mostly, I just told stories to my nephews, plagiarized things heavily, but I used to just make stories up to my nephews. And I looked and I thought, well, I've read so much fantasy. I thought, I'll have a go. And I looked at what she'd written, and I thought, well, it's set on another world. I'm not writing black culture. I'm just writing about people. They have dark skins. That's fine. They're people. I'm just writing people. So I took her descriptions and I started a story. And after a while, I'd introduced you more character, and I started to think, well, how do I describe these people? Because you're right, I am white. I'm white, and I am writing black characters. And I was thinking, well, if I pick up a book and I'm reading it, assuming that these are white characters, how are they described in the book? Do they specifically say lily white skin? Not usually. So I decided that there would be the occasional reference to the fact that they've got dark skin, but that most of the time I don't really make a big thing of that, because they don't in other books. So I set off writing. I did, I will admit, forget at one point that Trerin had ebony skin and when I made him blonde. But then I decided, what the heck, it's another world. He can be blonde. And then I carried on introducing more characters. I thought, well, should I introduce some white characters? And I thought, well, the thing here is, I'm writing this story for Tina. She wanted this story to be people she could relate to, with an idea for role-playing. It's her story. I wasn't even thinking about publishing or anything like that. It was just a short story I was writing. So I thought, no, I'm not going to introduce white characters just because I'm white. This is her story. I'm going to write what she wants. And I started putting it online where she could read it. And she loved it. It was her idea in the end that I should start trying to publish it. And then, of course, I did get to the point where I had to introduce some bad guys. And well, then I started to think, well, if I make them Caucasian, people are going to think I'm making a point here. And that's not why I'm writing this. I'm writing a story for Tina. So that was why in the end I made them albino, just to try and, it is complicated. It's such a minefield. I'm trying to avoid the mines. But I am aware that it is a very sensitive thing. And some people do think that you shouldn't be writing other people's culture. But then it seems to me, for example, if I was writing a story set in the 16th century, that's not my culture. I didn't grow up in the 16th century. I would be writing someone else's culture, even if the skin was the same color. if we only write about the things we know, the people we know, the life we know, then every single book in the world would be about our street. You know, I'd be writing about my flat. And that's silly. You know, you all across the world, people write books about things that are in other countries, other worlds, other places, because we've got imagination, we can research, and people are just people. I mean, we react the same way, we think the same way. It's not that, like, you're right, trying to write a story for an alien race. You know, I am, because my books are set on another planet in another time. So I guess in a way they are an alien race. But that was the thing. I'm not attempting to write black culture, because that would be silly. I don't know very much about it. I grew up in a part of England where I think there were two families of dark skin. There was a Chinese family, but the rest of us were all, you know, white English. So I'm not trying to write anyone else's culture. I'm just writing a story set in another world. I'm making the culture up as I go along. But it was Tinya's story, so the characters are the characters she wanted. And that was why I wrote it as I did.
I like your response to that, because I recently wrote a story. It's a historical romance set in China and in America, going back and forth with the Chinese culture. And I don't know much about Chinese culture. And as I was doing all my research for that story, I came to appreciate the culture in a way I hadn't appreciated before. I mean, this is thousands of years of recorded history that the Chinese have. And it's so complex and diverse. You can't narrow it down per se. And so I just took a slice of life from just where my story is going to take place at, just slice of life. But I like the fact you said, hey, you know, I'm not writing about black culture. I'm writing a story with people of color as characters. And I commend you for that, because some people will say, you shouldn't write that. And I would be very frank and say, I want someone to dare tell me what I can't write. I just want someone to tell me what I can't write.
Right.
Because I'm going to write as the muse lets me write. You know what I'm saying? Especially, like you said, if we all wrote the same stories, then we only know we're not really explorers. We're explorers. We explore through culture. We explore through stories. Stories that bridge us together. And so I really like the fact that you did that. And I'm glad that Tina challenged you to do that, because now you have four books out there. The series is called Guardians of Race. The fifth book is coming out in 2020. And so you're just going on with it. And guess what? One challenge for a short story is now over thousands of words long. So not thousands of pages, but thousands of words long. So for those of you listening to the sound of our voices, we are talking to Joan Lightning. She's the author of the series, The Guardians of Race, which is available on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. So make sure you go ahead and pick up your copy today. We're going to go ahead and take a quick short break. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Don't go anywhere. More with Parker and her guests on the Right Stuff Radio Show. We'll be right back.
If you are an author looking to gain visibility for your books, then AuthorShout.com is the place to go. We have a wide variety of affordable products and services, to include a member zone that will help you get the word out about your books. Our team here at AuthorShout.com specializes in creating stunning digital products, to include book banners, teaser videos, book trailers, book covers, and a whole lot more. So what are you waiting for? Stop by AuthorShout.com today and let our team connect you with a world of new readers.
Question: if you write a book, everybody will rush out to buy it. Obvious answer: no. If you were a celebrity, or if you had a huge marketing budget, then maybe you can get a lot of exposure for your book. Another solution would be to check out JoeyTweets.com. JoeyTweets.com is a promotion and marketing service with access to over 1/3 of 1 million followers on Twitter. JoeyTweets.com has 3 packages available to fit any budget. That's JoeyTweets.com. JoeyTweets.com. Get some serious exposure for your books.
We're back, and you're hanging out with the queen of Tuesday night, Parker J, and her guests right here on The Right Stuff.
Hi, and welcome back to the show. You're listening to The Right Stuff here on WPJC 104.5. We are talking to Joan Lightning. She's the author of the series Guardians of the Race, available on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. I have been just so titillated by Joan's story. She is an archaeologist, a martial artist. She's a knitter. She's a sewer. She's a photographer, amateur photographer. She does so many different things. Plus, she writes. And she's written this wonderful series called Guardians of the Race, available again on Amazon.com. Or if you're in the UK, because she's hailing all the way from the UK, go to Amazon.co.uk and pick up your copy of Guardians of the Race. The book starts off with book one. And let me tell you, the covers of these books are absolutely phenomenal. They have these luscious, gorgeous characters of color. In the first book called Falling Shadows, which is volume one of Guardians of the Race, you have this beautiful ethnic woman with this gorgeous green hair that just flows all over her. And, of course, I can't help but think of Under the Sea with the Little Mermaid. That's the only thing that comes to mind as I look at it. But I doubt she's under the sea. She's on an alien world. And so, Joan, tell us a little bit about Guardians of the Race, but no spoilers.
Okay, no spoilers. Guardians of Race. Race is their world, and it's also their continent. About 3,000 years ago, there was a war between a race called the First Ones. They were supposed to be protecting the people who were developing on this world, but they had a bit of a falling out. I refer to it as a contagion of violence. As at the end of the war, they've wiped out almost everybody they were supposed to be defending. And the Lord of Light takes the survivors and he merges them with the surviving population, and their children become the guardians of this planet. It's their job to protect from any more outbreaks of this contagion of violence, because there is one survivor of the rebels who is infected with this contagion, who's sealed under a cave under the ice at the North Pole sort of thing. He's contagious. And there are people who seek him out, who then become his followers, and they're the antagonists of the story, the Xiandu, also known as Zindans. That's all 3,000 years ago. It's now the survivors. They've spread out. You've got one kingdom is descended from these people who are part the older race, part the newer race. They're the guardians of race. They're also called Tyrians. They've all got magic powers. Only two of them will have all seven magic powers, but they've all got at least one. And they're tasked with protecting all the ordinary people who live across the continent. There are eight kingdoms. I try to avoid the seven kingdom cliche. At start of the story, there's a young... I use the term sorceress. It's not sorcery in Earth terms. These are gifts from the Lord of Light that they're given to do their job. There's a young sorceress whose name is Christu. She's 21. She has all seven of the gifts, so she's a Rikatu. She's also a princess. And she has a dream where he's called himself the Shadowbringer. He's the last survivor of the rebels who's in prison, who's come to her in a dream and basically says, I've chosen you to be my bride. You're going to have my babies. They will free me from my unjust imprisonment, and I will make you a goddess once we rule the world together. Her response is a slightly wordy no. Definitely wordier than that, however. These Dark Lord types, they don't take rejection at all well. So he throws a bit of a temper tantrum. And says he's going to plunge her world into darkness unless she changes her mind. And then she wakes up. She's off in one of the Outer Kingdoms with her Ponfor, which means a protector, friend, confidant, advisor, Tam, who also turns out to be her love interest as the story progresses. It's not a romance, by the way. There's a little bit of romance in there, but it's not a romance, if you see what I mean. He insists they've got to get back to their home kingdom straight away and seek advice from older heads. And that's how it starts. I don't want to go into spoilers about that bit. But as the story progresses, they begin to realize that this followers of this Shadowbringer are doing something. They're moving. There are rumors of strange things happening around. For example, in book one, towards the end, one sorcerer who's gone out and discovered that there's a snow ants infestation near a city called Angate. Snow ants are rather nasty little creatures that suck warmth out of anything living and turn them into snow and then use the snow to build an ant nest. Their anthill is just a little bit bigger. It's about the size of Mount Snowdon in Wales. They're quite deadly. And so for book two, that's where they go. They go to Angate to deal with these snow ants. But they're still trying to work out where the main attack is going to be because they don't know. There's something called a gleaning, which is, I assume you know what a word of knowledge is. It's somewhere between word of knowledge and spider sense. I guess I read Marvel. So there's a widespread gleaning where people have a vision that something dark is going to sweep over the land, threaten everything. The heroine, Christu, sees a giant wave of some sort. She sees a circlet, a pomfrel circlet, which is something that her pomfrel wears. Other pomfrel, they all wear them. It's a sun symbol that they have strapped to their forehead. She sees that on the floor. She sees a bunch of other things. And they then have to start trying to work out what these visions mean, what's going to happen, at the same time as trying to work out where the main invasion is. And in book one, you do learn that it's taking place at a port. I don't really want to say too much more about that, but yeah, they find there is an invasion going on, but they don't know for certain in book one exactly where it is. They send out a couple to go and check out strange rumours of this invasion, but they don't believe it because their enemies have never invaded. Not like that. They usually attack in groups of three or four. So they've never had a mass invasion like this before. Book one very much is setting the scene in many ways. To be honest, originally books one and two were one volume. I was advised to split it. I would have preferred to keep them together. But it starts with the original short story. For section one of book one is the original short story, starting from the vision and ending with Christu saying to Tam, I don't think this has ended. I think he's still going to do something. And then from there on, that was the point when I'd written the short story and I suddenly sat down and thought, I've an idea where this can carry on. I'm going to try and write more. And just kept writing and writing and writing. It took 4.5 years later, I got to the end of the first draft. It's twice as long as Lord of the Rings. I did write the whole thing. And during the second half of it, Tina, who I'd wrote it for, was saying, you've got to publish this. But I didn't want to publish until I'd written it, because I didn't know if I could finish it. But I did. Sorry, that's my phone dinging. Turn the volume.
No problem with the phone dinging, because you're telling us a fascinating story. I don't want you to tell me more about the other two books, because we definitely want to invite callers and listeners to get a copy of the series Guardians of the Wraith. And let me tell you, when you look at these covers just are to die for. They're so beautiful. They're so mysterious. They give you that fantastical element that I know you are going to enjoy. And when you look at the reviews online, the reviews are phenomenal. People really are enjoying Guardians of the Wraith. What have people told you about your book? How have they responded to them?
Well, those have actually found me. Obviously, some of the first people were people I knew. I mean, one guy who I hadn't seen in years said to me that he started reading my books, and you know, he was really glad he'd invested his time in my books. And he does keep sending me messages saying, when's the next book coming out? When's the next book coming out? To me, and to be honest, this laptop I'm currently speaking into is mine because he likes my books. And I did have one person who read volume one and went, you're a Christian, aren't you? Because although the books aren't specifically Christian, the story has a great deal about faith and being steadfast to your beliefs and it was also things like questions of how do you decide what is honorable if God tells you to do something you think is dishonorable, is it? There's a lot of faith based things in there, and the guardians are very much servants of the Lord of Light. They see their role as being there to do what He wants them to do. They are his protection for the rest of his people, and that's how they view them. They're like, their role is very much they are doing what God is telling them to do.
Well, that's a nice thing about the subtlety that you can have with speculative fiction. You can add those belief systems in there, especially for Christian writers. You know, maybe you don't want to be overt, but you want to slide those things in. I'm glad that you did that. And the person was like, you're a Christian, aren't you? It's like, yep. Guilty as charged. You know, like guilty as charged, so that I'm not guilty anymore. I am made free. I'm innocent now, you know, for the blood of Christ. But yeah, I love that you added that element to the story. And I'm glad that we're able to showcase it on the show all the way from the UK. You know, I know we didn't have a lot of time to go through everything, but I want people, if they want to connect with you, where can they find you online?
Where can they find Troy?
I said, where do they connect with you? On your social media?
I'm on Instagram and I'm on Facebook primarily. I don't get on very well with Twitter. But I'm on Instagram at the moment. I am serializing book one, and I'm also painting background scenes for the serialization, which are scenes from the book. And I do it in little stages. I change a little bit. At the moment, I'm painting Tam's home. Tam is one of the two main characters. He lives in a homestead. So I am actually painting his home and adding a little bit every day. And that is the background image for the serialization, which is on Instagram. Instagram, I am lightning_PJ. Facebook, I think I'm Guardians of Wraith. I'd have to bring the thing up. But I'm on Facebook as Guardians of Wraith. And you can follow me there. You can follow me on Instagram. You can follow me on Twitter. But to be honest, I don't post there very often. But those are the two main ones, Instagram and Facebook.
Now, this show is always about encouraging authors to pick up a pen and use the gift that God gave them and write. What would be some encouraging words you would give to our aspiring authors out there today?
Just do it. Just sit down and start writing. At first, I mean, you're going to make loads of mistakes, but you get better. And the only way to get better is to keep doing it. And you just keep writing and you keep writing. Yeah, I mean, volume one, I found a few mistakes. You know, it was my first book. But you just do it. The only way you will do it is to sit down and do it. If you say, I'll wait till I've memorized what the difference is between colons, semicolons, and dashes, you will never, ever get them right unless you practice. If you say, I can't start writing until I know how to punctuate prose perfectly, you will never learn to do that unless you start writing. The thing is, you start writing, you don't worry about doing it perfectly, because when you're creating, you're using one side of your brain. When you're trying to work out your grammar, you're using the other side of the brain. You can only use one side at once. Create. Write, create, then put it to one side for a week, 2 weeks. Come back, use the other side of your brain to sort out any grammar mistakes that you may have made. But just do it. Don't put it off. Don't think, I'll do it tomorrow. If you've got an idea, you've got a computer in front of you, you've got a pen in your hand, just sit down and start writing. You can always polish it later, but until you've written it, it doesn't exist. And that's I think that's the most important thing. You just have to know, if you think you'd like to write, write. Just get doing it. Find something to write about and write. And you will improve as you do it. Just remember that if you ask for people to give advice or to say what's wrong with what you've written, try to take a deep breath and remember that they're probably going to pick holes in it. And just say thank you and learn from what they've said. And you don't have to accept everything, but some of what they say will be right. But the only way to do it is to keep writing and keep writing. It's like running. I'm a runner. I'm a long-distance runner. I did my second marathon this year. You do not run a marathon by getting up off the sofa, never having run two steps, and thinking, I'll run a marathon. It's not going to work. You get up, you run two steps. Next day, you run five steps. Next week, you do park run. Week after, park run in a bit, and you just keep going, you just practice your running. Your legs start to get used to it, your muscles start to get used to it, your body changes shape, and within 6 months, you can do a half marathon. Within a year, you can do a marathon. But you won't do it if you don't get up off your backside and do it. I think that's it, really.
Joan, thank you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us on the show, especially calling all the way from the UK. So thankful you are here with me today. And I cannot wait to have you back and have you back real soon.
So hopefully maybe when I do get volume 5 done next year.
Oh, yeah. We'd definitely love to have you back then. Thank you so much, Joan.
Thank you, Parker. And thank you, Deborah, for suggesting it.
And for those of you listening to The Sound of My Voice, we were talking to Joan Lightning. She is the author of the series Guardians of the Wraith, available on Amazon.com. Or if you're in the UK, go to Amazon.co.uk and get your copy of Guardians of the Wraith. You are going to enjoy this. It is certified by Deborah Dunson. Thank you so much for joining for this edition of The Right Stuff. I'm the Queen of Tuesday Nights, Parker J, and you have a wonderful, absolutely glorious, blessed day.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of The Right Stuff. Follow Parker online at parkerjcole.com. To hear this show and other shows, visit the show archive at therightstuffradio.wordpress.com. We'll be back same time next week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time.